Coming up on Boston Public Radio, Scott Brown made it official last night in Portsmouth. His slogan, live free or log on. Adam Riley was there. Then he did the 9/11 fund. He was just hired to compensate victims of GM's skullduggery. But closest to home, he ran One Fund Boston. Ken Feinberg joins us. Then Kelly Crossley, over and under the radar with a new Anita Hill film, and Al Sharpton, FBI informant one day, host of The President the next.
Tax day is coming. To cheat or not to cheat, that is the question. Emily Rooney weighs in. Stephen Colbert is replacing David Letterman. We'll get her take, of course, her list. And then our Friday news quiz. It's Irishman versus Irishman. Tim Brannon of the Dropkick Murphys versus Brian O'Donovan of Celtic Sojourn on WGBH. Call back coming up on WGBH, Boston Public Radio, 89.7. Marjorie Egan, you're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Hey there, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
So it has been the softest launch in recent political history. For months, Scott Brown has been sending out pings, I guess you'd say, that he's considering, exploring, contemplating another run for U.S. Senate. But last night in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, Brown put an end to the speculation when he said this.
You know about a decision I've made. Starting today, I am a candidate for the United States Senate for the state of New Hampshire.
And of course, if he wins the Republican primary, yes, there is a Republican primary, he will challenge incumbent Democrat Gene Sheehan. GBH's Adam Riley was up there in Portsmouth last night. Hey there, Adam.
Hey, guys.
So it sounded sort of electric up there in Portsmouth from the cheering in the background. What's his pitch?
The pitch is actually really reminiscent of the pitch he used to beat Martha Coakley back in 2010. The pitch is... the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, was a disaster.
I thought you were going to say it's not Kennedy's seat. I was trying to figure out how he was using that.
No, there was no Kennedy reference yesterday, no reference to the victory over Coakley or the loss to Warren, not even indirect, which is kind of interesting. I thought he might say something like, you know, it's been a busy few years for me. But instead, he indicated that the campaign is going to be all about saying Gene Shaheen backed Obamacare. Obamacare has been bad for the country. It's going to be worse when provisions that haven't yet been implemented are rolled out. And if you send me there, I can help stop it. Very, very similar to when he said he was going to be the 41st vote against the ACA.
And I assume the reason he didn't reference Warren, well, he lost, that's not surprising, but even Coakley, is because there is this carpetbagger issue. The New Hampshire Democrats tweeted out something I thought was really clever a couple of days ago. Hey, Senator Brown, if UConn wins, don't forget to congratulate them. It's never too early to start laying the groundwork there.
I mean,
they're
going to
play
clever.
The carpetbagger up big time, right?
You know, they're going to play that card. But as John Sununu,
the elder.
Yes, John Sununu, the elder, noted yesterday, Gene Shaheen was born in Missouri. Plus, you have, I think, about 45% of people in New Hampshire who aren't from there originally. So I don't really know. You know, the Democrats will have some fun with that. Brown and his surrogates will say, well, Shaheen's not from here either. And I don't think that's going to be a big...
He was born down the street from last night, wasn't he?
Yeah.
At the Portsmouth
Naval Yard.
His
parents lived in New Hampshire, met in New Hampshire. Yeah, brought him home to a house on Islington Street. And, you know, that's the sort of material that Scott Brown is really good at delivering. And he delivered it artfully yesterday.
But, you know, it does seem to me that you got to have something a little bit more than Obamacare. I mean, we get these emails constantly from people that listen to us up in New Hampshire. One of them, our friend Christopher, is very politically involved up there. He's a Republican and says that, you know, Shaheen is very bipartisan. A lot of Republicans like himself like her. She's got this long history there. Her husband is very steeped in politics up there, and she's a real tough campaigner. So, you know, Obamacare and what else?
Well, it is not only about Obamacare. I mean, I think that's going to be the focus, no question. That'll be, you know, points 1 through 5 on the campaign trail. But he gave a pitch about President Obama's foreign policy that sounded almost identical to what former Governor Mitt Romney had to say in that Wall Street Journal op-ed a couple weeks back. Of course, not coincidentally, these guys share an inner circle of advisors. It was, again, a very Romney-esque pitch. You know, the president's leadership has been weak and indecisive. America is no longer strong. Bad actors around the globe are, you know, comfortable acting with impunity. Gene Shaheen is not making a difference on this front. I can help make a difference if I go to Washington. Also, he had several veterans, military veterans, in the audience last night and made a point of recognizing them, talking about his service in the National Guard, and saying that Jean Shaheen was insufficiently respectful of veterans because, if I remember right, she voted to cut their retirement pay. And he got a ton of applause when he said, I promise you that if I'm that, when I go to the Senate, I will never, ever, ever cut benefits for veterans.
By the way, he's got a new slogan, too. We mentioned that the memorable line, a very memorable line from the debate with Martha Coakley was, it's not Kennedy's seat, it's the people's seat. Well, he unveiled a new campaign slogan for Senate last night that I think we'll be hearing a lot in the months ahead. Here it is.
Now, as many of you know, I worked with Senator Shaheen in the United States Senate for 3 years. She's a nice person.
Very.
Let me repeat that. She's a very nice person, but she's wrong on the issues affecting, as you go along and you learn more and more and more about Obamacare, it forces us to make a choice. Live free or log on. Right? Live free or log on. And guess what? Guess what? In New Hampshire, guess what we choose? We choose freedom.
How many times do you think we'll hear that between now, assuming he wins the primary, and there is a primary with three other Republicans, how often do you think we'll hear that between now
and
November?
I'd say from 15 to 20,000 times.
I would say at minimum.
I liked another good line in Matt Stout's piece in the Herald today, tagging her as a Bay State liberal. I mean, that wasn't bad either.
Well, just to talk about that the praise he lavished on Jean Shaheen there about being a nice lady, a very nice lady.
We know, yeah.
Right? Didn't it make you think of that first debate against Elizabeth Warren, when right out of the gates he went after her for saying that she was Native American, and went on for about 3 minutes, and then John Keller from WBZ threw it to Warren, and she said, "I was going to say that Senator Brown's a nice man," or something like that. So I think one of the huge, fascinating questions around this race is the extent to which he has learned and will continue acting on the lessons of that defeat to Warren, because his big strength is being this sort of low-key, likable guy, and he was not that when he ran against Warren.
Well, some people saw him as a bully, and by the way, for those who recall, while he lost to Warren by 8 points, he lost to Warren amongst women by 18 points, which was huge.
And to me, the answer for the women is obvious. He's a gorgeous-looking varsity king kind of guy, and you don't like the visual. I think a lot of women voters, particularly older women voters who are very loyal voters, do not want to see the varsity king beating up on a grandmother. It just looks terrible, and that's, I think, what he did to Warren.
Yeah, I think you're right. So then the question becomes, when he's going toe-to-toe with Jean Shaheen, I felt like he wore his dislike for Warren on his sleeve in that last race. And I don't know if he's going to feel that sort of animus against Shaheen, or if he does, if he's going to be able to sort of keep it below the surface. My guess is he's a very, very savvy, sort of naturally gifted politician. So
he also is, he's a great retail campaigner.
Yes.
And while Massachusetts is a relatively small state, New Hampshire is a smaller state that loves retail politics. While Shaheen's very experienced, she's had 5 statewide elections. I think she's won 4 of the 5. She's very skillful. No one should take anything away from her. Brown is as good on the street, 1-on-1, 1-on-10, as anybody I've ever seen.
And last night it was interesting. When he was talking about his New Hampshire credentials, he talked about being born right by where his campaign kicked off last night. But he also talked about how much he loves the New Hampshire way of doing politics. Exactly what you were talking about, Jim. The fact that people want to meet these candidates. They want to meet them repeatedly. They want to go back and forth over the issues of the campaign with them. Now, it's something he has to say in a way to endear himself to New Hampshire voters, but I think you're right. I think it'll be a natural fit for him.
There is another side to this campaign. It's Shaheen's. Yesterday, a poll came out that showed Brown was only down by 8 points to her. And by the way, there's an internal poll. You never know if they're legit or not released, saying that he's actually leading Shaheen. But let's assume the independent poll is right and Shaheen's lean is only 8 points. She puts out a press release simultaneously saying she's raised a ton of dough already and describes him as a captive of big oil and Wall Street and Republican special interests. And it's pretty clear, just like the Affordable Care Act issue is going to be a centerpiece of his campaign against her, this captive of Wall Street, big business, big oil is clearly going to be a centerpiece of hers, no?
I'm sure you're right. And think you were talking about how many times we'll hear live free or log on. We're going to hear it ad nauseum. But remember how many times in the Warren Brown race we heard, whose side are you on, coming from Warren, or some iteration of that. This is the question of whose side you're on. I don't know if Shaheen will take that verbiage and echo it. Maybe that'd be too derivative. But yeah, trying to frame him as a tool of big business, big oil, the 1%, I'm sure that will happen.
I know you're going to be all over this thing. I don't know if you know the answer to this yet, Adam, but it seems to me that if I'm a Republican, traditional Republican in New Hampshire, while my number one goal is winning, my number two goal is being respectful of Republicans in New Hampshire. While Brown is not the reason for the following, the media is, it's almost as if there's not a primary. There are three people running against him, or he's running against three people. Is there any level of resentment that he's trying to Bigfoot this thing, even though all he's doing is advancing his own campaign?
I don't know if there is that specific resentment out there. What is there, and I think could be a problem for him in the primary and in the general, is a sense among hardcore conservative New Hampshire voters that he is too liberal. That especially on gun rights issues, which they call, you know, or which many people call Second Amendment issues, that he has been open to some forms of gun control and that they simply can't vote for him in good conscience. I think there is going to be something of a conservative push against him, probably not big enough to make the difference in the primary. But if you think, if the general ends up being really, really close, if those conservative voters stay home, and several of them told me yesterday outside the kickoff, they said, if I have to vote for Shaheen or Brown, I'm not going to vote for either one. In a close race, that could be a difference maker.
Well, except everybody said. I mean, you know, at the beginning of every campaign, everybody's disgusted with everybody.
No, you know
Shaheen's
what?
Not liberal enough.
But you know,
Brown's
but you know
not
what, Jim,
conservative
people
enough.
People who really care passionately about gun rights, I mean, it is so important to them, and I think they act on it in a way that a lot of other people don't act on issues that they profess
maybe
to be
so
keyed up about.
Keith
we'll
just emailed us and reminded us of another thing that we're probably going to see a lot in this campaign is videos of Shaheen saying, if you like it, you can keep it.
Yes.
You like your doctor, you can keep your doctor. That, of course, again, is another reference
no question
to Obamacare. All right, Adam Riley, that was spectacular.
Hey, the pleasure was mine. Good
by
to see
the way,
you guys
the only
again.
Question I have for is the pile of money spent on this race by outside interests? Because, by the way, the ads from outside groups attacking Shaheen and Brown are already on TV. Is it going to be taller than Adam Riley? And I would say the answer is yes. Let the games begin. Adam, thanks.
Thank you very much, Adam Riley. Adam Riley is a reporter for WGBH and our resident political junkie. It's always great to talk to you, Adam. Coming up, we're talking to the man who's become the man whom we associate with national tragedies, arbitration lawyer Kenneth Feinberg. As we approach the anniversary of the Boston bombing, we check in with him about administering the money raised by One Fund Boston. That conversation is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
When the inmates run the jail and get the guards to do their bidding.
The Black Gorilla family corrupts these female guards, and then they bring in the drugs that meet the demand of the addicted inmates.
Jeffrey Toobin on the Black Gorilla family gang dominance of a Baltimore jail and what that says about the criminal justice system right now. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
We love our contributors. That means you and the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More information at Lincoln.com. And the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. For over a decade, Ken Feinberg has become a man who we associate with just about every large-scale man-made tragedy in our country. He's been asked again and again to do the unthinkable, to put a price tag on pain, suffering, and even human life. Feinberg, as you know, has managed compensation for families affected by the September 11th terrorist attacks, the Aurora movie theater massacre, and slog through the aftermath of BP's oil spill. Last year's Boston Marathon bombing brought the Brockton native back to his hometown to manage One Fund Boston, the money raised, as you know, to help compensate the victims and family members affected by last year's attacks. Ken Feinberg's latest book is Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. He joins us on the line as we mark the one-year anniversary of the bombings for an update on One Fund Boston and what he's been doing since. Ken Feinberg, thanks so much for rejoining us.
glad to be there.
So, Ken, you have said many times that you've been amazed in all your work at the charitable instincts of the American people. At the same time, you've also said that compensation funds can never really be fair. So explain your sentiments on those statements.
Well, the former statement is the reality that the American people seems to be part of our character, that in times of national tragedy that occupies all of our attention, front page news, the American people simply sit down in their own homes and their living rooms or their corporate board offices and write a check and send money in. And it is truly a remarkable thing to me to see that One Fund Boston in 60 days raised $61 million to be distributed to the 242 victims and their families of the marathon. And I just think it's an extraordinary thing. From the perspective of the donors, it is very rewarding and part of our national character. Now, from the perspective of the victims, this idea that money is an adequate substitute for loss or permanent injury is simply false. You cannot expect people who through no fault of their own have suffered such horror to accept a check and say thank you, or it was fair, or I'm pleased, or I'm grateful.
Yeah.
You just don't see that, nor should you expect it when you design and administer these programs.
You know, Ken, last time you were with us, you told us an incredible story about hopping on the subway in New York City. I think it was to go out to see a mother in Queens or somewhere who had lost a child on 9/11 and didn't want to file. I read in the last couple of days that there was a comparable situation here, that you met with a number of the victims prior to making decisions about how to dispense the $61 million and now more. You met with at least one person who said they didn't want any money. Describe that to us, if you could.
Well, it's an amazing thing. There are rare occasions, very rare, where grief is just so overwhelming that people don't act rationally. In 9/11, I told this woman that she was entitled to about $3 million tax-free, and she said, I lost my son in the World Trade Center, and you're here to give me money? Just leave the application on the kitchen table, and she never filled it out. In Boston, a rarity. But again, somebody just says, no, I just don't want the money. I don't think it's necessary. I'm not going to take it. Money is not the answer. And no matter how you try and explain to people, take the money. One less thing to worry about, at least, in all that you have to confront. Occasionally, very, very rarely, but occasionally, people are so paralyzed by grief that they that they refused the check.
Did the person in Boston who I know said that all he or she wanted was their leg back, they didn't want the money, did they ultimately file with the fund?
Well, there was one person who said that to me, and they did take the money.
Mm-hmm. Glad to hear it.
But you can never anticipate. You never know for sure how people will react. Human nature being what it is, some people react very differently from others.
We're talking to attorney Ken Feinberg, who's well known for working on compensation disbursements, 9/11, the BP oil spill, and the Boston Marathon One Fund. Ken, you believe that the One Fund is uniquely successful, kind of the blueprint for others. Why is that? What's so great about it?
First of all, you had unparalleled, unprecedented political support for One Fund from the top. Mayor Menino, Governor Patrick, didn't just support the fund. They got on a soapbox and urged people from around the country to contribute. That had an impact. Secondly, at Mayor Menino's insistence, One Fund Boston was created solely for the purpose, with one mandate, to assist the victims of the marathon bombings. In other words, they wanted to make sure our elected officials, the governor and the mayor, that the money not be dispersed too widely among varying other funds, So they focused all of their attention on one fund. And finally, of course, was the national publicity surrounding this great patriotic holiday and the horror that ensued. And there was a tremendous outpouring of national sentiment, empathy for the victims in the form of money, so that the amounts raised in 60 days into just one fund vastly surpassed any other private donation program I've ever heard of. In Connecticut, that horror, Sandy Hook, with all those first graders killed, 7.8 million. Virginia Tech, 32 students and faculty gunned down by a deranged student, $7 million. One fund, $61 million. It's just astounding to me.
And one of the things, as you've described it, Ken Feinberg, the focus on one fund that both Menino and Deval Patrick decided to do, they rejected your advice, from what I understand. Is that correct, that you thought that it should be through existing foundations and they held firm on this? Is that an accurate?
They were right. They were correct, yes. I told them initially, why don't we just, let's not waste time by asking the Internal Revenue Service for a new 501c3 charitable foundation designation. Let's just take, you know, one of the existing foundations in Boston and use that already in place vehicle for raising funds. And both of them told me, with all due respect, Ken, we want a singular, new, fresh, charitable foundation for this sole purpose. And, of course, they were proven absolutely correct. And it worked better than I had ever thought it would.
You know, I hate to put a bad apple story in the middle of this whole thing, but I just wonder, there was a story, you know about it, Ken Feinberg, of this a Boston young man, 22-year-old, said his aunt lost both legs in the marathon bombing, and he was lying, and he was arrested when the authorities were going there with a fake check for $2 million. Is that unusual? Because I know, I saw you have your picture taken with him. He looked like a nice guy. I mean, how are you supposed to know? I mean, is that, I assume that's unusual.
Very.
Very.
Very unusual. In the overwhelming number of all of these cases, take One Fund Boston, 258 applications for compensation, two allegedly fraudulent claims.
Huh.
In 9/11, 7,300 applications for 9/11 compensation, less than three dozen allegedly fraudulent applications. So I think fraud, you have to be ever vigilant. You have to run a crystal clear, transparent, open program with anti-fraud ability in processing and evaluating claims. But fraud as a numerical, quantitative matter is relatively rare, as it should be.
You know, Ken Feinberg, both Tom and Nina, we've had this discussion both with the former mayor, the new mayor, and with Deval Patrick. The question I'm about to broach with you, shortly after it was clear that One Fund was going to raise all this money and the leaders of the city and the state talked about how we were all one Boston and that sort of thing. A number of mothers, one after another, who had lost a son or a daughter or a brother or a husband in Dorchester, Roxbury, or Mattapan said, well, actually, you know, it's not one Boston. There's terror in our community, too. I can't afford to bury my child. And while I don't bemoan or criticize the decision to give $1 million or $2 million to someone who suffered a horrible loss on Boylston Street, there are two Bostons. And in fact, we interviewed, I think, 11 of the 12 candidates for mayor. Virtually all of them agreed there was that issue. How do you reconcile in your head that some get and some don't?
Well, life is unfair. I don't reconcile it very well. I'm not at all convinced these programs are a good idea. They are a reality. But you are correct. Bad things happen to good people every day in this country, and you don't have a One Fund Boston or a 9/11 fund or a BP oil spill fund or a Newtown, Connecticut fund. So it's a perfectly legitimate criticism that, you know, where's my check? I'm an innocent victim. And that's why I think it's very, very important to evaluate these various programs, not from the perspective of the victims. I can't make a distinction. But I think there is a distinction that you can make from the perspective of the country, where the nation rises up as one after 9/11 or One Fund, such unique, horrible tragedies that scar American history. And the nation responds. From the perspective of the nation and the donors, I can see a difference, not from the perspective of the victims.
You know, Ken, you used the word unusual a minute ago to describe something. And as you're talking, I'm thinking, and maybe I don't have it right, but I think I do. One of the most unusual parts of this One Fund is it happened at an event that's about to repeat itself. There's not going to be another BP spill, we hope. There's not going to be, you know what I'm trying to say, essentially the year... the anniversary comes again. Is your expectation that as we approach this year's marathon, and obviously the 15th, 6 days earlier is the actual anniversary, is the expectation that contributions are going to pick up yet again as people begin to focus on what happened last year?
There may be, although the American people, their attention span moves on to the next tragedy or the next crisis. There may be some additional funds. I don't know how much One Fund Boston will be promoting additional contributions. I'm long gone from that fund, but there may be. I don't think it is a good idea to dwell on these horrors and these tragedies, certainly not from the perspective of the victims.
Yeah.
From the perspective of the victims, here is the funds. Move on as best you can, and let's not revisit this horror. You're trying to adjust your life now going forward without a loved one in the home or with a limb lost or a double limbs lost. I don't think it's a good idea for One Fund or 9/11 or the oil spill or anything to dwell on this on an annual basis while people are trying to move on in life as best they can.
We're talking with Ken Feinberg, who helped put together the compensation disbursements for 9/11, BP oil spill, and, of course, the Boston Marathon. You know, I saw you yesterday morning on TV with Candy Crowley on CNN, Ken Feinberg, talking about the Malaysia Airlines tragedy. And she asked you, there's obviously talk about compensation there, insurance companies and lawyers and everybody else are going to get involved. She asked you what will happen if they never find the plane, in terms of all that, the lawyers and the insurance, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What would you tell her?
I don't think in terms of finding the plane or not is critical to the basic notion of compensation. There's an international airline treaty in place that says that if there's an airline crash, even if the plane is never found, the carrier, Malaysian Airlines, will compensate the families of the passengers up to an amount of approximately $175,000 each. And individual families can request more than that if they can demonstrate economic loss and financial wherewithal of the victim and all of that. So I don't really think that in terms of basic compensation to families of the victims of that flight, I don't think finding the plane is critical. Finding the plane may be critical for other reasons. If you want to bring a lawsuit in the United States against the manufacturer of the plane, not the airline, well, you first have to find the plane and see if, in fact, there was a manufacturing defect, or was it pilot error, or what have you. That's a question, a very practical question. Also, if the manufacturer is somehow liable, then you can go to another deep pocket, the manufacturer, and try and recover additional compensation over and above whatever Malaysian Airlines would pay. But in any event, as I said yesterday, you will not see, nor do you need to see, some sort of special compensation fund. I doubt very much that such a fund will be created.
Do you ever question your own judgment? You deal with some of the most difficult situations, have dealt with some of the most difficult situations one can imagine. After you make decisions, do you ever go home and say, maybe I didn't do the right thing?
Or every single day.
Do you really?
every single.
And how do you deal with? I mean, how do you deal with that internal conflict, for lack of a better expression, Ken?
You do the best you can. This is not rocket science. What I do, you could do what I do. There are thousands, maybe millions of Americans that could do what I do in times of a national tragedy, allocate and distribute money. It doesn't require a degree in physics. And I tell people all the time that when they say, you know, I don't think you did it right. Maybe I didn't. I did it the best I could. And if somebody can do it better next time, you do it. I don't go looking for these assignments. If you want, here is the pencil and here's the paper, you do it. And you decide how to allocate $60 million. I mean, it is judgment, and it is based on prior experience, trying to do the right thing in an area where the right thing is impossible. You strive for it, but you know before you begin, brace yourself. You're not going to please very many people.
Well, Kenneth Feinberg, I want to know on a less horrific issue. I read about you in Esquire magazine that when you and your family were trying to decide whether to buy a house in Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard for your summer getaway, that you were studying all this weather data and prevailing ocean and air currents, trying to figure out which airport was less likely to be fogged in, Nantucket or Martha's Vineyard. You decided Martha's Vineyard, and that's where you bought the house. I want to know, how's that worked out for you over this last decade? Were you right? Is the Martha's Vineyard Airport less fogged in than Nantucket, or were you wrong on that one, Ken Feinberg?
I can't speak about Nantucket. I ended up on Martha's Vineyard. I must say the house is wonderful. It's wonderful for another reason. It's wonderful because I have three children and now two granddaughters.
Oh, great.
And they love coming to Martha's Vineyard and playing in the sand and running around, going to the agricultural fair and all of that. So in terms of a hub to bring family members together from far away and far distances, it's a great magnet and a great incentive.
And they don't care about the fog. Hey, Ken Feinberg, last thing from me.
Jim. That's why they care about the fog.
The last two times we've spoken, I actually meant to bring this up, which has no relationship to these compensation funds. People may or may not know that when you were a mere boy, you were the chief of staff to Senator Ted Kennedy. And while conservatives love to describe Kennedy as the Antichrist when they're running for office, I think most people look back on him as the master of across-the-aisle deals. Do you ever say to yourself, when you see the gridlock in Congress, and John King, CNN's John King, is with us every Tuesday, says the least productive Congress maybe in American history, do you ever think to yourself about whether or not Ted Kennedy would have been able to break this gridlock?
I'd like to think, you know, Senator Kennedy was one of the great senators in American history. I'd like to think that he could have made a difference in breaking the gridlock. I'm not sure. I follow what goes on in Washington like everybody else does. And this notion that Senator Kennedy would have somehow been able to break through and secure Republican votes, and all, it's speculation. But one thing is not speculation, and that is he was a Senate giant, and I think everybody, Republicans and Democrats, recognize that fact.
Indeed. Hey, Ken Feinberg, thanks so much for your time and your work.
Thank you very much. I love talking to you, Ken Feinberg. I appreciate the time.
Glad to do it, guys, anytime. Thank you.
Ken Feinberg was the administrator of One Fund Boston. He's also the managing partner at Feinberg Rosen LLP and former U.S. Special Master on Executive Compensation. His latest book, Who Gets What? Fair Compensation After Tragedy and Financial Upheaval. I want to point out we taped that conversation with Ken Feinberg earlier this month, one day before he was tapped by General Motors to advise them on the victims killed or injured in cars the automaker is now recalling. Up next, we're going to talk with Callie Crossley. She's going to join us to talk the big headlines of the week and the stories that went under the radar. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Friday, is the host of Sunday Nights Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. That must be Callie Crossley. Hello, Callie.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
Hello, Callie Crossley. So you and I got all revved up this week when we went to see the new Anita Hill documentary. Jim hasn't seen it yet, but just so people get a flavor of this, and then we can talk about it. Here's a little clip from the documentary aptly named Anita. Oh, the computer fell asleep. We will not have the nice little clip. Maybe we will later in the show. But anyway, I went to see it at Kendall Square. You went to see it at Kendall Square. To me, she is huge in the women's movement in America. What did you think about the documentary? What do you think about her?
Well, I think, you know, the world of her. I think she, the way that she's able to comport herself at that age, at that time, in those circumstances, and then through the years as well. What you learn from that is, first of all, you forget that so many people don't know this story and they don't know the details. And you become horrified all over again at the way that it was handled. And then I'm struck by, I went through a range of emotions, I should say that. So I went through, you know, the anger, then the mad. Then I got actually teary, you know, because I thought she was so naive to think they're going to believe me. I have, you know, it's clear I have no reason to lie, and to go there and tell her truth and to keep saying it and to keep saying it and to realize, oh, my God, not only do they believe me, you know, they're in effect in the way they're questioning me, calling me a liar. And she still stood up in the face of that. And then after it was over, to say that the thing that struck me was that I thought, she said she thought, you know, maybe 2 years, people ask me about this, then it'll go away.
Yeah.
You know?
The computer is awake. We do have a clip. So let's hear the clip from the new documentary, Anita.
The sexual harassment storm around Clarence Thomas is intensifying.
I trust that the Senate will confirm this able man promptly.
Once it gets subpoenaed, I knew what I had to do. I'm going to tell what happened to me.
She had no idea that she was walking into the political lion's den.
You swear to tell the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
So if people do not know this story, we should point out that Anita Hill was this young lawyer. She was working for the Equal Opportunity, the EEOC, whatever that thing stands
for. Equal Opportunity.
Clarence Thomas ran the whole thing. She's a young African-American woman. He's her African-American boss. And he, in a way that other people have corroborated, because she was not the only woman, talked to her about, you know, who put the pubic hair on my Coke can and made all these references to pornography, and just, and he kept asking her out. She didn't want to go out with him. And later on, when he was nominated to go onto the United States Supreme Court, she just sent very quietly her, they asked her about him. She quietly sent her statement. It was leaked, and the you-know-what hit the fan, and suddenly she is this 35-year-old black woman called before a Senate committee made up of all men, many of them elderly, and all of them white, and she's harangued and humiliated.
I mean, it's just incredible what she went through. And that can't be emphasized enough. She didn't go running around saying, hey, I know something about Clarence Thomas. They asked her, she wrote her statement, and she thought that was the end of it. And she actually thought maybe some other people would write statements as well. And to your point, many people were prepared to testify. I have to refer people to the book, the very fine book by Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson called The Strange Justice, The Selling of Clarence Thomas, because you will be horrified when you read it and realize how many lies, and I am using the word advisedly, how many lies, how much big political maneuvering with capital P, capital M went on to get that man in that position, down to blocking other witnesses who could corroborate her, what she said. They allowed some.
But we should say who blocked it, who was the chair of the committee at the time, who was wildly admired by a lot of people who celebrate Anita Hill. That would be Joe Biden, the vice president of the United States, who was then chair of the Judiciary Committee.
It is just horrific what they uncovered. And I'm glad it's there for a document, because you can't believe it. And there it is, you know, documented for all. But the other point I want to make is that another local person in this story who you really understand what he gave was Charles Ogletree. Now, people know him at Harvard as, you know, a very well-known and respected head of the center over there, well-known attorney. He just volunteered. He just thought there ought to be a black man particularly on her side. I mean, he couldn't have known, as none of them did, what this meant. And I just came away full of so much respect for him.
He was
great.
When
people go into the lion's den at the moment, you know, you got to got to give him some props.
You know, by the way, well, Charles Ogletree, since you brought it up, is now known as Friends of Presidents. He obviously he knew Michelle Obama and Barack Obama before Michelle and Barack knew each other. By the way, we should say I met him many, many years ago when he moved to Massachusetts from Washington. He was a public defender in D.C. This has not been a celebrity lawyer for his whole life. He's been in the trenches representing poor people. I mean, the whole spectrum of things.
But
he's amazing.
The big thing about Anita Hill, and you and I are old enough to remember this, that when you were came to work in the 80s, and she testified in 1991, if you came into the workforce in the 70s, 80s, as we did, or well before that when it was even worse, and you were a woman in an all-male operation, as most were, and everybody's boss was a male, I mean, sexual harassment was just part of your day. You had to figure out how to keep away from these creepy guys who were chasing you around the desk or doing whatever they were doing. And there was no one to complain to. I told this great story in my column the other day about this guy that interviewed me for a job in front of this picture of this huge naked woman. And every time his head moved, you know, the breast popped out on this side, the breast popped. I mean, these are like 5 foot. I mean, it was huge. And I said to him, you know, I can't concentrate. It was unbelievable. Can you imagine that today? So my daughters and everybody's daughters are on Anita Hill's shoulders because even though people questioned her, the workplace changed. You may still have sexual harassment, but at least you can go complain to somebody.
Yeah, you know, the thing that comes across in the movie is that those guys really, or they pretended they didn't get it. You know, and you know, what do you mean? Somebody actually said to you, "Yeah, that's what he actually said." And you know, I've experienced it too. Way many years after Anita Hill, you know, made her stand, you know, in my work situation and having to take that up a few notches to my bosses and say, hello, what are you going to say to this guy?
Yeah.
You know, this is not appropriate.
Two quick things before we leave this topic is one, for those who are wondering whatever happened to Anita Hill, she's been a respected and is a respected professor at Brandeis. She's been there for quite a while now. The thing I was most worried about until I read the review, and again, I'm going to see it this weekend, I haven't seen it yet, I was worried that it would not include what apparently is the opening scene, which is the incredible voicemail from Virginia Thomas, who is the wife of Clarence Thomas, in October of 2010, who leaves a voicemail for Anita Hill asking whether she was ready to apologize 20 years later to her husband, meaning to Clarence Thomas, or to admit that her testimony in 91 was fraudulent. It is one of the
most surreal
things maybe ever in American politics.
And remember, at the time, Anita Hill thought, this has got to be a prank.
I remember, yeah.
You know, it can't be the real woman. And it just caused me to think, well, where was Clarence? In the shower? Because this was 7:30 in the morning. So I'm thinking, what's going on? And what would make her think about her in that way to call at that time? It was just too crazy.
One last thing I'm just going to say, recommending this documentary for people who haven't seen it. It is stunning to remember. She was 35 years old. How much class and dignity she showed a relatively young woman with all these like 65 year older guys with all the spotlights going over her story again and again. It's a real inspiration that a woman that young could comport herself. She was the so-called perfect victim, right?
I so admire her composure at that time.
She's now, a piece of work.
Sadly, Kelly, you didn't make the cut for the quiz today. The quiz today is our Irish Spin quiz. Tim Brennan from the Dropkick Murphys, Brian O'Donovan from Celtic Sojourn. Since you didn't, I'll ask you a question anyway so you can feel included. What do Al Sharpton and Whitey Bulger have in common? You have 10 seconds.
FBI informants.
Describe this story for those who are either fans or detractors of Reverend Sharpton.
Well, apparently, back in his tracksuit days, not the new and revised Al Sharpton, Reverend Al Sharpton, he worked with the FBI with a briefcase that was bugged. Now, there was some controversy when this story broke that he said he didn't have a bug briefcase, but he did. So he finally said, yes, the briefcase was wired to record. My mind is blown. Like, how in the world would he end up in a conversation with members of the Genovese mafia family?
Is that
family?
Ever explained? I've read a ton about this.
Well, apparently he had complained to the FBI. This is what he says. He's not, first of all, it should be known that he says he wasn't an informant. He had actually complained to the FBI saying there's some suspicious, awful stuff going on with black people in the music industry, and we need to look at that. And as a result of that conversation, then he was asked, because I guess some of the mafia people were involved in the music industry, well, would you go undercover and, you know, gather up some information that would document that? somewhere in there, in the FBI's mind anyway, not in Al Sharpton's, he then therefore was an informant because he had 10 meetings with, you know, high-ranking people. And as he had 10 meetings with them, and I don't know, can't figure out how that came about, the guy starts telling him about extortions, killings, this and that, which is recorded. And I'm thinking, why would you tell Al Sharpton this? I don't know. It's just bizarre all around.
And what's bizarre is on the heels of this coming out, and there'd been some notion of this in the past, but the smoking gun did a Freedom of Information request, got all these documents, published the documents, etc. On the heels of that, just coming days after, who is speaking today at the annual Civil Rights Summit that Sharpton has in New York?
But National Action Network, which is his organization.
Right, the President of the United States of America. And I have to say, I'm not a huge Sharpton fan at all. And I read what the new mayor of New York City said about him when he spoke, de Blasio, raving about what a great leader, how important he is in New York. Eric Holder, the attorney general, talk about irony, head of the Justice Department, speaks, I think, yesterday. Never, obviously, you can't mention the FBI thing there. And today, after being at the LBJ 50th anniversary of the signing of the Civil Rights Act, obviously in Houston, at the LBJ Presidential Library, I guess yesterday, it was yesterday. Today, he's with Al Sharpton, he being the president of the United States, with Al Sharpton in New York City. It's just...
Let me bring our two stories together and quote Anita Hill when she was asked at a meeting I attended about a year or two ago. You seem to be the perfect person, the questioner said, to be on the Supreme Court. So what do you think if someone nominated? You could be nominated now. What do you think? She said, that would be awkward. So I think it's the same thing.
What a great line. It's a great line.
In this scenario, thinking about President Obama and Al Sharpton, that's awkward. Yeah. I mean, this is just, really?
Very awkward.
It's just,
you know,
bizarre.
Speaking of mentioning LBJ, one of the conventional wisdom as to why Barack Obama, by the way, a number of presidents have stayed away from the LBJ memory, for lack of a better expression, because until recently he was remembered primarily as the Vietnam president. And now he's being seen, obviously, on the 50th anniversary as a civil rights president. One of the reasons that even liberal columnists say that Obama has rarely mentioned his name is not because he doesn't care about civil rights, obviously, but because he doesn't want people making the contrast between maybe the greatest deal maker in the history of the presidency, that being LBJ, and Barack Obama, who is having real trouble getting anything through unless he has enough Democratic votes, the most recent of which is this, what's going to be a failure of the so-called Paycheck Fairness Act. Tell people what it is and where that stands, if you can, Kelly.
Well, it just got voted down by the House for the third time. This is President Obama's continuation, I think, of his mission to try to close the wage gap between women and men. Some deny that exists, but, you know, the Pew Research Center, you know, they've got documentation. You can argue whether it's 77 cents, as some say, is the figure. And that's what President Obama says. Others say 88 cents. The Pew says it's anywhere between 84 and 93. The bottom line is there's a gap. So what are you going to do to close it? The first bill that, as you know, that President Obama signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Act, and she filed suit because she found out her coworker was making way more than she. She couldn't have done anything. She lost the suit, as you know, because the statute of limitations ran out. But she couldn't get access to the information to tell her how much. So what he was doing and what some of this bill would do is make transparent, you know, who makes what. Back pay for people who've been discriminated against. It's a lot of ways in which to close the gap. Now, they're all good things. Believe me, I have a vested interest in this. I would like to see this happen. On the other hand, we know that it didn't really have a chance because he was pretty much beaten up on the Republicans about their lack of interest in this the day before. And it's a political year, and so some people are not going to give him.
One last quick thing on this that I don't get. I was naive enough to think that the NRA was going to surprise everybody and support limited background checks so that they could say for the next 20 years, don't say we never compromise. We compromise on one of the most important issues of the American people. I was naive enough to think on this. Because it is relatively innocuous. I think it's a good thing, but it's not huge. It doesn't change the world. I was naive enough to think that there'd be enough Republicans. They got 53 votes in the Senate, all Democrats. Harry Reid voted against it, so I could bring it up again, the head of the Democrats. I was naive enough to think seven or eight Republican moderates would vote for it. So the Republicans can say, hello, We vote for fairness issues. We vote for middle class. We're not anti-women, but not one Republican
not
in the Senate voted for this
thing. But not a political win for the president. And I think, you know, from the Republican standpoint, they're like, yeah, that's what we think, all the things that you said. But I'll be daggone if I'm going to give him a victory around it. So we're just voting against it. So in the end, women still have the wage gap. And by the way, it should be made clear that there's two things operating. We're talking about women clustered in those entry-level positions who are not paid well to begin with and then have a gap. And then you're talking about the lack of women at the top rungs where there's real money to be made, where there is less of a gap, but still there's not that many up there. So that's the reason why this wage gap persists, one of the, a couple of the reasons.
I was surprised to learn it was illegal to talk about your salary.
Yeah, exactly. That's Lilly Ledbetter.
Talk publicly about your salary.
But I didn't know this was as widespread as it apparently is.
Yes.
You also think...
And in fairness, the Republicans had an amendment to the bill, and that's their amendment, would have said it's okay to talk about your salary.
Yeah.
So that's what they offered to the bill, but you know they knew it was they were going to vote
no,
it down.
But that's not what it said. It said you can talk about it, but you have to use Pig Latin to talk about it. That's that was part of the Republican. Callie, what are you doing Sunday night on Under the Radar with Callie Crossley? What's up?
Well, the first part of the show, we're going to be talking about the 18th annual Immigrants Day at Beacon Hill, and what we're talking about is the sophistication now of the immigrants who are coming to talk to the lawmakers, and the lawmakers' better receptivity to a broader range of issues that immigrants have. And by the way, when we say immigrants, we don't just mean Latinos. There's lots of other groups here. We did a show on Basic Black last week.
I saw that. That's a fascinating fact.
Yes, about Africans and folks from the Caribbean who are now a rising group of immigrants in Massachusetts and nationwide. So there are a lot of issues to consider, and they've broadened their appeal, and we're talking about that. Last half of it, we're talking with Ambassador Swanee Hunt about the under-the-radar take that she has, the perspective that I wasn't aware of, on the 20th anniversary of the Rwandan genocide. She's identified how women have led the path to reconciliation, and the people who are in power now, in terms of legislative power, are women. It's like the New Hampshire legislature. It's amazing. And she explains why it was possible for women to step in after that brutal war and be able to rise to those positions. So that's truly an under-the-radar story that we like, and it's a fascinating one.
We'll be listening.
Okay.
Thank you, Callie Crossley.
Callie Crossley is host of Under the Radar, which you can see every Sunday night at 6 to 7, and she is with us every Friday. Callie Crossley, as always, thanks for talking to you. I love the Anita Hill thing. I have to go back and see it again. Revved up again. Okay, up next, we're asking if you have or have been tempted to cheat on your taxes. The Justice Department never indicts someone over a single tax return. Rather, could this be the year, the one you cook the numbers? That's up next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This is 89.7 WGBH.
From NPR News.
From the WGBH radio newsroom in Boston.
Your home for public radio.
We talk with big thinkers.
What's the point and who's doing it?
Please support it at WGBHnews.org.
Mix one American woman trained in French cooking, a few broken eggs, and a dash of improv. I'm Kara Miller, the recipe for Julia Child's success on Innovation Hub, Saturday morning at 10 here on WGBH Radio.
Funding for our programs comes from you.
And Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life. And Sprout Space by Triumph Modular, sustainably designed permanent and temporary buildings for classrooms, labs, and office spaces. That's Sprout Space by Triumph Modular. More information at triumphmodular.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And it's April 11th, which means it is nail-biting time this weekend because April 15th is tax day, just 4 days away. As Benjamin Franklin famously said, the only thing certain in life are death and taxes, but a big difference between taxes and death is you can't cheat death, but you can cheat on your taxes. A new survey shows that a vast majority of Americans say that cheating on taxes is unacceptable, but the minority, roughly 12%, say it's fine to underreport income, claim bogus deductions, or inflate your credits. We want to know, what about you? Have you ever cheated on your taxes? If you have, why? And if you haven't, why not? Is it because you're an honest soul who believes in the integrity of the system, or simply because you're worried that if you did, you'd get caught? Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. To cheat or not to cheat, that is our question. And whichever decision you make, we want to know why. I am of the – now, I'm much more cynical than you, and I know that, and I admit it up front.
I'm pretty cynical, Jim.
I am of the – first of all, the 12% number is ridiculous. That's 12% who admit that they're cheating on their taxes. I would argue – I don't have any objective evidence that the number is higher. Secondly, I would argue that there's so many people who want to – what's the expression? Stick it to the man to pay – you know, I'm angry at the government about this. I'm angry about that. That if they could be convinced that they wouldn't get caught –
oh,
and I'm not defending this at all. In fact,
right.
I'm criticizing. They'd be cheating. And by the way, the bad news for the Honesty Brigade is all these articles that have come out in the last week, including places like Newsweek, saying that there are so few people doing audits and the budget of the IRS, the Internal Revenue Service, has been so cut back that if there was ever a time in American history that you could cheat and get away with it, it is now.
Well, not only that, they talk about the fact that the regular workaday Joe that's getting a paycheck week by week by week, it's much harder for him to cheat than the people that are doing all these
Well, obviously, because your wages are reported on. Right.
Yes, and how they're the ones that are really getting away with murder, and no one's catching them because they don't have enough people as they used to catch them. I mean, I think that's the big motivation. People are afraid of getting caught because there's a lot of hostility toward the government. You know, it's funny though; there might be more hostility toward the local government, which puts you in a dilemma because except for your property taxes, you're not really, that's the big thing from the local government. But people get upset.
I think it's the opposite, by the way.
Well, I think
they like best the government closest to them because they can see the results.
But you also feel as though you're getting ripped off, like you were 1 second late and you got a parking ticket you got pulled over because you didn't have because you forgot to renew your registration. They slap on $75. That's the state, Department of Motor Vehicles. So you're sort of hostile toward your local government, but the one taking the big chunk of your paycheck is the federal government. So maybe you're just transferring or you're one of those people, that says you do not want your money to go to these things like wars.
Or a lot of people don't, who have no problem with money going to wars, have a lot of problem with the choices government makes, the federal government makes, and that is the biggest chunk. But apparently, at least according to polls, and I not only looked at this recent poll, it's generally 1 out of 7 or 1 out of 8 people who admit that they cheat on their taxes. Again, we want to know if you're amongst them. We're not going to trace the call. And if even if you don't or say you don't, we want to know if you think that this number is real, or are people just too nervous to admit to a pollster that they may be somebody who skims on the edges? I'm not talking about somebody who is doing, just lying and saying I didn't work last year when they made $172,000. But and the troubling part of this for those who are on the edge saying, well, I don't know if I should cheat or not. I'm an honest person. The people who get away with murder, according to all these stories, are people whose income is not wages. They're not a salaried person. The hedge fund types, the others.
A lot of them are wealthy people.
Where the IRS has virtually no ability to have, nor the skills to monitor these people, but it's what it is. In any case, 877-301-8970.
I did not know this.
What's
you could
that?
Collect a hefty ransom if you're willing to rat somebody
out
to the IRS.
Whistleblowers, yeah.
I did not know that.
Up to 30%. If they owe more than $2 million, it's something like 15 to 30% of what the government recoups if you blow the whistle on a friend or a coworker.
Well,
this is horrible.
It's really not your friend. If
and
you're
up
blowing
to
the whistle
well,
on
a former
them.
Friend, and if it's up to $2 million, meaning any amount of money, I think it's a 15%. It's a lot of money.
It's
I can't
lot.
Believe there aren't people who do that and nothing else for a living. And I'm serious. I mean, it's a bounty. It's a huge bounty.
Yeah, but how would you know? You might know in your company, or it might be if like your ex-husband or ex-wife, you're trying to get even with them, you might turn them in.
I would say that the odds are if you turned in 10 people you know well, the odds are pretty good that a couple of them are going to end up paying you a bounty.
877-3-0-1. Only 12%, Jim, says it's okay to cheat.
8970. Let's take a couple of calls.
Okay, let's go to Anonymous. Oh, my goodness. You're very nervous about this. From Southern Massachusetts. Hi, Anonymous.
Hey, Anonymous.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Excellent.
Great.
Thanks.
You know, I'm not necessarily nervous, but, you know, why take any additional risk? I'm a public radio junkie, and, you know, I like to talk to you folks. I'm 39 years old. I haven't filed a tax return in 12 years.
And have you made money for all those 12 years?
You know, I have made money, but I have not exceeded, you know, for the past few years, I haven't exceeded more than $17,000, $18,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of those years, I was in the $20,000 a year range. And, you know, it started off innocently enough because I knew I owed a little bit and I couldn't afford to pay it. And from there, it just kind of kept going. And the fact of the matter is if I paid what I truly owed, I would not, it would make, you know, life and living and getting by and paying my day-to-day bills pretty much unviable.
Do you have any moral compunctions about, other than anxiety, which I don't know if you have anxiety about getting caught, but assuming you don't for the moment, do you have any moral compunctions about not paying for a dozen years, Anonymous?
Well, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is I mean, I am having taxes taken out of my paycheck. So it's not like I'm not paying anything. But I claim a higher number. So the amount taken out is not the amount that I would actually owe.
Wait a second. You're a wage earner, meaning that the government gets a W-2 from your employer most of those 12 years and they have never caught up to you?
That is accurate.
That is unbelievable.
Wow. I mean,
the fact of the matter is, you know, I don't, while there's got to be something, I don't know that there's all that much, you know, dollar-wise that I would be responsible
right.
for. So I guess part of the thing that helps me from not having too much anxiety about it is I figure that they have bigger fish to fry. Than,
now, Anonymous,
than me.
Can you stay on hold? Eric Holder's on the other line. He'd like to talk to you. So just stay on hold.
Yeah.
I got to go now.
Okay.
Anonymous, thank
you. The federal agents are in the hallway.
Now, that sounded, one of the arts you develop, you think, when you do what we do for a living, that you can tell when someone's telling the truth. I think he was telling the truth. Do you?
It sounded to me like he was telling the truth.
Yeah.
But I'm surprised with a W-2, he could get away with that for that long, because they usually do. You know, I've heard stories of people's kids, you know, they're just out of school making like peanuts, and the IRS is asking, where is your...
Can I tell you, I was audited 2 years in a row about 20 years ago. And by the way, I'm proud to say I had a no change outcome, which means they accept it. It is the most terrifying, torturous. First of all, you have to spend days preparing. You have to go through every receipt, everywhere. And then they really put you through the ringer. And while you're relieved at the end, if you get no change, meaning you don't owe any more, you don't owe any less, it is hell on earth, I am telling you. It is just, and my assumption was once it had been twice, it was going to happen every year, but luckily it hasn't since. In any case, they should go after Anonymous instead of me. Deborah, we have his phone number too. Deborah in Bridgewater. No, we don't. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi, Deborah.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for calling.
I'm glad to. This is the first time I've ever called you guys.
Oh, great.
I like the show.
Well, thank you so much. We're glad you did.
Oh, well, anyway, I don't want to sound like Pollyanna. I know that
that's okay.
It, but I feel like I've never cheated on my taxes. And I'm a small business owner. And someone once said to me when I opened my business, like, oh, if you don't cheat, you're not going to make it. And I just, yeah. And I said, well, no, I don't intend to do that. And I guess my reason is, you know, we have, like I said, I'm going to sound like Pollyanna. I'm wicked sorry. But I feel like when you pay your taxes, even though you may not like to, it's like taking a pound of flesh, and sometimes, some years for me, it is. I feel like it's like my number one way to like do good for my community. So like, if I don't pay, then that person I love or know might not get the services they need because they can't afford it because they didn't pay my taxes.
I can't believe you waited so long to call, Deborah. That was great. You know the great line, I think it's Oliver Wendell Holmes, is it taxes are the price we pay for civilization? And essentially, you are Oliver Wendell Holmes, if I have it right, in Bridgewater in 2014. I don't think it's Paul. I mean, hopefully that is the attitude that most people have. But there's so much anger and there's so much polarization that I fear you're the outlier, not the norm. But Deborah, call us again soon. That was a great first call. We really appreciate
it. Well, you have a great day. Thanks.
You too.
Well, thanks,
Thank you for the call, Deborah. I think a lot of people, especially when you're older and you've been living in your house for like 70 years.
She's not older.
No, I know she's not. But I'm explaining to people that get upset because suddenly the tax bill on their house is like 10 grand a year and they're living on Social Security. Those people are in terrible straits.
Well, those people who are, the Cambridges experience that a lot of places.
Yes.
Property rich and,
yes.
And cash poor. It's a real problem when you bought a house ages ago, and even if property taxes, and they happen not to be exorbitant in Cambridge compared to some other communities, but if you've owned the house forever, the good news is you own the house. The bad news is the property taxes are often more than someone on a fixed income can afford.
So you would not feel that was the price of your civilization because you would feel as though you were getting driven into the poorhouse or having to sell your house and move into a closet.
Well, if it turns out, though, you have responsible elected officials like we occasionally have in Cambridge, they have, and I don't know if Brookline has this either, they have these property tax breaks for senior citizens, which is some recognition of the fact that they have it. My guess is the vast majority of people who are cheating on their taxes are not seniors. Let me put it that way. I just don't think so.
Okay. Let's go to Ken in the car. Would you cheat on your taxes, Ken?
If I could, I would. Absolutely. So this is a good follow-up to Pollyanna. I'll tell you, I'm just tired of it. My son, I was telling the story to the person that answered the phone, back about 10 years ago, he traveled a lot on his particular job, and he got audited. And he had falsified, you know, some of the gas and some of the travel and some of the blah, blah, blah. And he got caught, and they went after him like he had just shot the president. And I'll tell you, it just bugged me. 3 years in a row, once he got a different job, his tax return just went to the government. I'm like, hey, it says that. That's life. That's the way it is. But it just cracked me up. He's making like $27,000 a year living in my house, and the IRS is going after him, and there's somebody on a yacht sailing around the world who's paying nothing and beating the system.
But now, Ken, I think you're every man, or at least a lot of men, exactly. When you read these newspaper articles about zillionaires paying virtually nothing or absolutely nothing in taxes, or you read, was it GE? That for years was paying absolutely nothing despite many, many billions of dollars in profits.
Well, yeah.
Ken's attitude, I don't think, is an aberration. Ken, thanks for the call.
I'll tell you, too. I mean, even myself, like I said, I've never cheated only because I don't have the guts to cheat because I've been caught my whole life with doing anything that I did wrong since I've been 7 years old.
An honest man.
Yeah, so I said the heck with it. But, I mean, we get a bonus every year at a particular company I work at. And my wife gets all excited and blah, blah, blah. They say, okay, I'll take 43% off of that. So almost half of it goes to taxes every year when we get our bonus.
Hey, Ken.
And I mean,
We got it. You expressed yourself well. You're an honest man. Thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you for the call, Ken. You know what was a really upsetting story, this Newsweek piece about how to cheat on your taxes? Mm-hmm. It talks about this guy, this Jerry Kernut, a former IRS guy.
An auditor at IRS.
Yes,
yeah.
Who figured out that the IRS was losing all this money because they weren't doing something about Line 10 or Schedule K or something like that. And he's gone around to all these states and said, we're talking big-time money. You could save billions of dollars.
Right, they don't even look at Line 10, the auditors.
That's
his
right.
Contention.
And the only state that would have him come in was your home state of Pennsylvania,
yeah.
When Ed Rendell was the governor there, was a big Democrat, and then they got an anti-tax Republican, and Mr. Kernut was disinvited. But he's talking about how in Pennsylvania, the time when they had this guy advising their local people how to collect federal income taxes, they collected an extra $50 million in unpaid state taxes. So that really enrages you, too. And the people that are using this Line 10 and Section K, whatever it is, are not the people making
$27,000. Exactly. They're not wage earners. Exactly.
No, they are not.
Okay,
it's outrageous, Jim. We should all be cheating on our taxes.
Let's go to Greenfield. Marjorie doesn't mean that, by the way.
I do not mean that.
Let's go to Greenfield. Tyler's on the phone. Hey, Tyler.
Hey, we've talked a lot about like morality and doing your duty to paying your taxes. Forget about state taxes, too. So I just wanted to ask you guys if you guys pay the higher optional rate in Massachusetts, and if not, why not? And do you know anybody that does?
I pay it every year. Yes, I do, Tyler.
By
the way, for those who don't know what the optional rate is when taxes were lowered, I can't remember what the rate was, something in the high fives, was it 5.95 or something? And now, Tyler, we didn't hang up on Tyler. He just disappeared. Now it's the low fives. If you want, you can check a box that allows you to pay voluntarily at the higher rate. And I think the statistics come out every year, Tyler, and I think it's something like 300, 400 people in Massachusetts. One of your colleagues writes a column virtually every single year at the Herald asking if John Forbes Curry has paid at the higher rate.
And Elizabeth Warren. It goes after all the Democratic politicians asking if they pay at a higher rate. And I don't think anybody is paying at the higher rate.
Well, I said a couple of hundred people apparently are. Let's take one more quick one here. Ira, you are in a car. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Ira.
Hi, folks. How are you?
Excellent.
Great.
Thank you.
Good. Good show. No,
thanks.
My opinion that I think realistically everybody cheats. I guess, first of all, define cheat. I think about, you touched on it, Jim, but one of the points that I wanted to make was take a look at GE and what they did years ago.
Yeah.
And everybody was in outrage. You know, corporation changed all the rules to suit their legal strategies. I know personally I delay in filing my taxes, partly because I'm a procrastinator. But also, I've had accountants advise me, file late if you can. Just get extensions, do all that. And then they get their quota for audits, and, you'll be past that. I do other things, which I have a side business, and I underreport income and whatnot, but I think,
I love how matter-of-fact you are, Ira. But you've thought this through,
yeah,
obviously.
You have to deal in cash only, I think.
But, Ira, the point you make, and again, I'm not justifying what you are doing or what others rationalize themselves into doing. It is true when you see the front page headlines about GE making billions and paying nothing, you do say to yourself, I don't have the ability to do the kind of creative accounting that their high-priced tax preparers can do, and there's a horrible inequity in that. So again, it shouldn't lead you to cheat. It should lead you to advocate that they change the laws, which is never going to happen. In any case, Ira, thank you for the. Was that? Oh, I'm.
I mean, you may be cheating yourself on it.
Yeah, Ira, we're losing you. It's a bad connection. Thank you for the call. Well, that was depressing.
Yeah,
there was that
depressing.
One woman. Was it Deborah? Who called herself a Pollyanna?
She's very patriotic, pays her taxes, calls it the price of civilization. Emily's cheating on her taxes. Is that correct?
No, she is not. She is not. Never, never.
You'd like to get the check I wrote.
Up next, Emily joins us. She is not cheating on her taxes. She's here for open mic and her famous list of obsessions and observations. Stay tuned for Emily on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
They say that some folks have never seen Ireland for themselves. Well, what are you waiting for? Join me, Brian O'Donovan, this October for an Irish sojourn through the scenic southwest of Ireland, a place so lush and green, you'll understand why they call it the Emerald Isle. We're also bringing legendary singer-songwriter Robbie O'Connell along for the ride. But space is limited. Please visit wgbh.org/learningtours for more information.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Harvard Vanguard Medical Associates, an affiliate of Atrius Health, providing quality primary and specialty care so that you can focus on what matters most in life. You can find a doctor near you at harvardvanguard.org and experience better care for a better life. And Marble and Granite, searching the globe for countertop materials to provide a wide selection for their customers. You can view their inventory online, including their new product offering, Color Quartz. MarbleandGranite.com.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3, as she is every Friday, for open mic is Emily Rooney. Hello, Emily.
Hey, Margie. Hey, Jim.
Hello, Emily. Well, earlier in the show, we talked to Adam Riley about the big race brewing up there in New Hampshire, Scott Brown versus Jean Shaheen. We know it's going to be a smackdown money-wise. Could be kind of exciting. What do you think? Do you think Scott Brown can pull this off?
You know, it's interesting, Adam's take on this, that he's going to go back to his old ways, which is the way he was when he ran against Martha Coakley, sort of the puppy-faced underdog. I don't know if he can really regain all of that, but he is the underdog, so he thinks he's going to take a wholly different approach.
Yeah, but I, as I said to Adam Riley, though, I'm not sure. He's got to do something besides Obamacare, I think.
But you keep saying that, Marty. It is April. He's starting off his campaign on something that he thinks appeals to the base.
Yeah.
The notion that he's not going to broaden his agenda, just like Shaheen is going to broaden hers.
But I agree. It's a hammer that isn't working. I mean,
yeah.
It's like she voted for Obama. Yeah, yeah. So did most everybody else.
It's kind of like that was the Coakley race. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be the 41st vote against Obamacare. I'm going to be the 41st vote against Obamacare.
And he won.
That's not why he won.
Yeah. Well, it was a piece of why he won. And by the way, the Affordable Care Act is not wildly popular. It's not wildly popular.
Martha Coakley didn't want to stand outside of Fenway Park.
Well, that's the line.
And he had the pickup truck, and he had a barn coat, and he came out of nowhere, and he was appealing. And Martha was not a dynamic campaigner, and that's why he won. I could be wrong. I don't think it was about Obamacare.
Well, you know, Jean Shaheen, while she's a really seasoned politician, and she's a really smart politician as well, I don't think she'd be offended if she heard me say, she does not have the politicking skills that he does. He is really, as I said to Adam, the guy really knows how to campaign. I've told the story before. I'll tell it one more time now. Mm-hmm. Not 2 years ago, when he's running against Elizabeth Warren, I get early to the St. Patrick's Day breakfast because we're broadcasting on NECN. The room is beginning to fill up. Maybe 500 or 1,000 people are there, all Democrats, every single one, who's the only politician in the whole room that early in the morning. Scott Brown shaking every Democratic hand.
And well, James Pindle from University of New Hampshire said the same thing, spent a day with him on the campaign trail, said, and he's covered every political campaign in New Hampshire, presidential, everything else. He said he's never seen anybody with those kind of retail politics.
Oh, he's a rock star.
He likes
He loves it. He has a great time. He's very charming. He's got a great sense of humor. So he's got a lot of political skills. And he's going to draw huge crowds. I mean, even if you're not inclined to vote for Scott Brown, you may show up at a big Scott Brown rally just to see the guy.
Okay, so somebody else won another election, which to me, at least in the short run, is more important. Here is the great Stephen Colbert discussing the retirement of the great late-night icon, David Letterman. Listen.
This man has influenced every host who came after him and even a few who came before him. He's that good. And I got to tell you, I do not envy whoever they try to put in that chair.
I was sad when Letterman said he was retiring next year because I love him. I love Colbert even more. I am really excited about this.
It's just interesting. I know everybody's commented on this, but to see him be himself, take him out of this character that he's become. I mean, I can remember when he first started. Well, he did that reporter on The Daily Show. So he's always done some kind of a character, but I had seen him back then as himself. It'll be interesting to see what he's like.
And he has said specifically that he will not be his faux conservative character.
It won't work.
For an hour a night. You know what was the most amazing statistic that I saw? There was something, and Matthew Gilbert wrote a piece about this, praising on April 10th in The Globe, Stephen Colbert, a wise choice to succeed David Letterman. I was floored by this. The average age, what do you think the average age of a Jimmy Fallon viewer is? If you didn't read this, if you read it, don't guess.
Jimmy 50? Fallon.
I would have said 35. The answer is 57.1.
Yeah.
The average age of a Letterman viewer, 58.2, which doesn't surprise me. The average age of Jimmy Kimmel, who I love, 54. Average age of a Stephen Colbert viewer,
25.
42 years old.
Oh,
the youngest by far of all the late night hosts.
Central. It's part of it is the network.
You don't think people will follow this guy? I do.
Oh, no, I do. But I also think that the networks are anathema to people like my daughter and your kids probably. It's like they drift to these other places to get, Comedy Central.
What, do you think he loses part of his whatever
when
he goes
there? I think
he
will, especially if he stops assuming the persona. Yeah, he will.
Well, it's going to be because my kids, like your kid, it's all Jon Stewart, Jon Stewart. And then, of course, Colbert's on right after Jon Stewart. So they just stay there for the, or they watch it online.
That's where they get all their news.
Yeah, so they get all their news. So it will be interesting to see if they switch over. You know, Katie Eastman, a reporter at the Herald, has got a great story in the Herald today about she was a Cub reporter, as Colbert called her, out in Iowa. And I guess Colbert wanted to run an ad.
For his pack,
at this TV station in Iowa, and they wouldn't accept it because it was some ridiculous thing or something. So then it goes after Katie Eastman, this little Cub reporter, and points out how she's covering this longest garage sale in the history of Iowa and how she's covering some scrape at the dog park over people picking up after their dogs and stuff. And she became, for like 2 days, this national phenom.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's a great little piece. It's a great little piece if people haven't seen it. And you look at the YouTube videos of Colbert and Eastman. It's a riot.
Yeah, the only bad. Were you surprised? I mean, you have a little bit of a CBS connection, and I know it's there's a new guy in town, comparatively speaking.
Well, Letterman has been there a long time,
right? But I mean, has he been president? How long has he been?
Oh,
he has.
Long
okay,
time, yeah.
So Letterman just announces last week that he's leaving. He's not leaving for a year, give or take a month. And Colbert is picked in a week.
In the works.
Now, I was just going to say,
of
it means they were obviously negotiating a deal, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, fine. Okay.
You couldn't have possibly have done it that quickly.
Okay. I want to run an idea by you that I have been advocating for ages, and I think I'm getting closer, even though for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
We've read that Newbury Street will be closed for the day of the marathon on April 21st. Primarily, no, not closed, the humans, closed to automobile traffic, in part to cut down the crowds so there are fewer people in Boylston Street, et cetera. This is the police department making this decision. I have been an advocate forever that just like in my hometown, Chestnut Street, which is sort of our Newbury Street but not quite as ritzy, should be closed down to vehicular traffic. Let it be a promenade where people can just walk from Arlington Street to Mass Ave, at least in the spring, summer, and early
Saturday
fall.
Saturday and Sunday only.
Right. Well, maybe. I would do it all the time.
Too much business. A tremendous
amount of
business.
Okay, let's start with Saturday and Sunday. Wouldn't you?
Yes.
You're a back bay type. Wouldn't that be great?
Yes. It's frantic right now. And also, it has become a showcase for people coming from the tunnels and bridges, if you follow me, for their motorcycles and hot rods.
If you follow
it's
me.
It's awful. All last weekend, that's what they were doing. Room, room with the aftermarket pipes and all that crap that they, you know, really, it's just wrong.
People riding their motorcycles on Newbury Street?
Oh, this is a thing.
It is?
Oh, yeah, and they come with these big, huge aftermarket pipes, and they're all, you know, with the decibels of about 100. Yeah.
But yeah, by the way, we knew that there's going to be a personal thing
in
for
the summertime.
Emily here. But it goes beyond that. One, you can't park. Two, you can't drive down the street anyway because
everybody's
if someone is trying to park.
Everybody's walking in the crosswalks.
So why don't you join my campaign? Let's start with Saturday and Sunday.
Fine.
Let's start advocating for. So we are?
Yeah.
Well, then fine. Okay, let's have another traffic
thing. This is one of the great stories of all. And kudos to my colleague at the Herald, Mark Garfinkel, who took
the picture.
He took the picture yesterday. There was this terrible fire in East Boston, and this BMW had parked right in front of the fire hydrant. So what do the firefighters do? They put the hose right through the windows. They
smash
the windows on the driver's side. They smash the windows on the passenger side. Great picture about this fire hydrant thing. And I thought to myself, number one, this person will never park their Beamer in front of another fire hydrant. Yeah. But number two, many people have been tempted, particularly places like Newbury Street.
Never.
Handicapped spots, fire hydrants, fire lanes. Most people don't do it. Lots of people are tempted. This guy did it.
I mean,
he got totally nailed.
Yeah, all the stations all had video of it last night, too. I was getting a big kick out of it. I mean,
what a great
the
picture.
One, if you're going to stack these offenses, parking in handy, I mean, there's so many handicapped parking places. I've never done it, but it's definitely tempting. Never a fire hydrant.
Tempting.
Oh, well, there's too many of them. It's crazy. Well, we've already been through that. Way too many handicapped parking places. But to park in front of a fire hydrant?
He got his due. And it makes it so much better. It was a BMW.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a Hyundai or something.
Exactly.
Well, did you make the point you made to me upstairs? I was looking at the pictures. So I didn't hear every word you said there. What was the thing you said to me this morning as we're sitting upstairs in the newsroom about the hose going through the window of the BMW?
Well, the firefighters did not have to put the hose
through
the window. I mean, they could have just put the hose. It was behind. The fire was behind.
Of course, that's the best part.
So they could have just put it over the top of the car beside. They said, we're going to get this guy good.
Exactly.
And his car is a total mess. And then he's going to have to sheepishly admit, or she, it could be a woman,
too. I wonder if they've towed it away yet.
I don't know. But it's just one of the great
stories. They could have gotten a tow truck there pronto also.
Well, the picture went viral. People went nuts over this.
I know.
And everybody was dumping on the person parking the car there. But I think
they're assuming it's a guy. I wouldn't make that assumption.
Could be a woman. Could be a woman.
What do you think,
Jim? I hope it's a really obnoxious guy. And I hope his picture's on the front page of the Boston Herald
tomorrow.
It's
more likely to be a young woman.
Why do you say that?
Oblivious.
Why, really?
Yeah.
Ooh.
Well, that could be. Totally oblivious.
But you know what's going to happen, by the way? The public policy advance, thanks to the firefighters. Who's going to park in front of a fire hydrant again, at least in the foreseeable future after seeing that photograph? nobody. Yeah. Is that a safe assumption?
You know what I want to know? You're Mr. Traffic Safety over there.
Yes, I am. What do you want to know?
How many feet do you have to be from a fire hydrant?
5 feet.
Is it 5 feet?
No, it's not 5 feet.
Emily Rooney.
It's more than five
feet. That's what it is.
Is it 5 feet?
Yeah.
Because you did see people park
It's different
often close
from city to city. And you do, 5 feet.
5 feet, okay.
That's not totally true. 5 feet unless you want a hose through your window, exactly. In which case you can park as close as you want. In any case, we're glad to talk to Emily about anything, but the real reason she's here, of course, is this.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
We all smile like little children when this happens. And by the way, our crack researchers, our colleagues say, Emily Rooney, it's 10 feet. Yeah. Not 5 feet. They looked it up. So
then a lot of people are breaking the
okay,
rules.
Okay, let's all move right. it. So is that what you're saying? Is this thematic? I ask you that every week. Thematic? It's not?
Yeah, it is. And it's not really. Oh. There's one theme here. And okay. You'll just be happy to know that I'm back to my old ways.
Oh, good.
You know, I've gotten
complaining.
Back to my...
Yeah,
exactly.
Great.
Oh, good. We love complaints. Complaints.
So this is Emily's list of things that just make me crazy. Now, I realize some of these are going to be irrational. And
it's
so
okay.
You can't press me. You can't go deep on this.
Okay, fine.
Jim is going to be like,
no,
well, what is it about?
I'll be
that.
Nice about it. Go ahead.
It's just go with me on
okay,
this.
Okay, fine.
So I always read those State House news bulletins of what's happening on the Hill today. And,
yeah,
you know,
sure.
I go through all of them. And sometimes there's some interesting stories there. Every single day, without exception, there is at least one or two, whatever motions, whatever it is they file or make, to put time into somebody's sick bank.
Yeah.
It drives me crazy. What is this about? This sick bank thing. I'd like to have a sick bank.
Do you want to know what it is? It's when you don't even want to know.
It drives me crazy.
Someone is seriously ill and their coworkers want to help them out.
I can't
help
it.
How do you know
that's what
it's about? Because I used to be a lobbyist.
Maybe somebody's going to the Caribbean.
It's just like, no. It's a no. They need to come up with something else.
This is not going to be pretty. Okay, go ahead.
All right. So the other day I'm watching HBO and I don't know, just landed on something. It's nudity, a lot of swearing. 2 seconds later, I go, boom, and I hit my little cable button. Now I'm watching CBS. And it just dawned on me how stupid this rule is, that you can swear and have full frontal nudity on HBO but not on CBS when the delivery system is identical.
I am so with you. It's absurd.
It is stupid. 1 second. I didn't even have to do anything clever. Just... It's a dumb, dumb rule.
So do you want nudity everywhere or nudity nowhere?
Well, by the way, after a certain hour, you and I have had this discussion forever in the wake of The Sopranos. I mean, it was a similar sort of thing. We had this discussion with Bob Thompson, our TV guy from Syracuse. When you watch The Good Wife, which I really like, you know that it is absurd that there is not, for example, swearing in some of these intense situations. That's the way people are. And I am totally with you. It's a totally arbitrary,
or even non-gratuitous swearing. I mean, when people in a news situation swear, they have to cut it out. You know, somebody's being swallowed up by a mudslide, and they say, holy, and they have to cut it out.
I'm like,
out of your mind. This doesn't work.
This isn't so irrational so far.
You probably won't like this. I am against any law with a cute name that includes Melanie's Law, Melissa's Law, or even the Voters' Rights Act or whatever, because it often belies something else, which is some kind of civil liberties or, I mean, three strikes in California. That was what it was. That law spoke to what it was. But Melissa's Law is also three strikes. It's just too cute. And
no,
we all
Melissa's
are sympathetic.
Melissa's Law is named after Melissa Powell, who was killed by a drunk driver.
No.
Oh, Melissa's got Melissa Gossel.
Yeah.
That's
habitual offenders. I'm sympathetic to both families, but I just don't believe in naming laws. I told you this is, I know.
Okay.
All right, here's another one.
Horrible.
Emily's list of things that drive me crazy. All right.
Fine.
Embargoes. This is preposterous.
Oh, yeah.
In this
Explain
day
what
and
it is.
Age,
I'm with
Explain
you.
What it is.
News media outlets agree to, and usually some sanctimonious organization like JAMA or Harvard or somebody. So here's one I got in the mail the other day. I swear to God, this is real. This was embargoed. This came from This is embargoed until Tuesday at 11 o'clock. The winner of the MIT National Collegiate Student Prize Competition was embargoed. It's like, what are you talking about? You know? And now in this day and age, you can find out what somebody's, a couple of keystrokes, and you already know what's in somebody's press release. So it's like, why would you honor this?
Why don't they just send it to you the day it happens instead of having to embargo everything?
Because they want the Globe to have it first. That's why. You know that.
Is that why?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just listening.
That's why they do
it. I'm with
you
on that.
Everybody wants the Globe to have it first.
Well, so are you saying that the Globe gets the embargo notification first?
They get to have the release first.
So that they can write the story and have it ready.
Yes, embargo.
They get to break it.
Okay. That's outrageous.
We
should put a stop to
that.
He knows it's true.
We don't want the embargoes going to the Boston Globe.
This drives me crazy.
Yeah.
When people ask you to take your shoes off when you come into their home.
It's ridiculous. No, I am so with you. It's insane.
Now, I thought that was that. I know, but
I've got really bad feet. You used to have bad feet. I can't.
Yeah,
my feet are all wrapped and bandaged.
Jimmy, you have beautiful feet.
I do. I have really
except
nice
for the plantar
feet.
Fasciitis.
Oh, God. I don't have that anymore. That was 10 years ago.
And Morton's toe.
I don't have that either. I don't have that. No, it's a joke, but it's not true.
But hold on. But this is a cultural thing.
I know. I know.
Well, see, I'm fine with it. If you're going to an Asian household, for example, and there's a cultural tradition to take, I'm fine with that. But when someone asks you because they have new rugs or something, it is so offensive.
But you're right.
It is ridiculous.
Suppose you have a foot problem.
If you're on a boat, and I understand on a boat, I always bring socks or something because I can't go barefoot. But if they blindside you, you're going to somebody's Christmas party or something, and say, oh, leave your shoes. What?
Yeah, not at the Christmas party.
No.
You
Let's
can't
lead
have
a crusade
that.
On that, too, when we're done with Newbury Street.
And as long as we're talking about shoes, every time I think about this, it just drives me crazy.
What
that
is it?
One guy, this Richard Reed, put a little matchstick in his shoe, and for then, millions, if not billions of us have had to take our shoes off. It is dumb.
Okay,
now,
next.
Aren't they
dumb.
Changing that someplace?
Yeah, it's been changed. Actually, I went through the other day without it, but I can't even remember why.
That's ridiculous.
I'm not on any special
your
list.
Your belts, your shoes.
This drives me crazy. All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Those evacuation route signs.
Oh,
I laugh.
No,
I sometimes get giddy when I think about it. Oh, you know, here comes a hurricane or, you know, a nuclear cloud. Let me see if I can find those evacuation signs and start heading out of town. I mean, it's just
you see them near where you live,
ugly.
By the way. They're all
everywhere.
Over the place over
and
there.
And there's a thousand of them.
Wait a minute. You know what's crazy
every 10
about
feet?
Them? When there is no emergency, you are sitting in front of the evacuation signs going nowhere because you're in rush hour traffic. So you can just imagine what will be happening when you're trying to evacuate.
Dumb. It is dumb. And it's environmental pollution. We should get a
that'll be
committee.
It's our third crusade.
All right, and finally.
This is
a perennial
finally,
for me. Downtown parades, walks. Last week was the Greek parade.
Marjorie.
Coming up is the hunger, the breast cancer, the please, please, ladies and gentlemen, maybe we just send our checks and stop.
Well, by the way,
nonsense.
You know, Scott Leahy wrote a column about it in the Globe a few years ago, and Marjorie is the worst. And you know why she's against all these walks?
Because I live on the street with all
because
the walks.
Because she can't cross Beacon Street and Brookline during a walk.
I think
please.
We should spread the walks around.
All right,
send
what
them
are you
over
doing?
Exactly.
Send them over to Hyde Park.
What are you doing on Beat the Press tonight, Emily Rooney?
Let's see. We're doing Colbert. We're doing, I don't know.
Whatever. We'll watch.
And
7 o'clock.
More importantly, Band of Boston tonight. Are you coming, Marjorie?
Oh, I don't think I can.
I'm going to be Martha
Stewart.
Are you
Stewart.
In it? Yeah, I'm
going to
be Martha Stewart. Yeah.
Terrific. Goodbye.
All right.
Goodbye.
Maybe
good
I will. If I get out of work early enough, I'll come.
See you,
okay.
Guys.
Emily Rooney joins us every Friday for Open Mic, but you can keep up with her weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2 for Greater Boston. And tonight, 7 o'clock, Beat the Press. Coming up, it is our Friday news quiz. Irish Spring here at WGBH, a Celtic Sojourn's Brian O'Donovan and Dropkick Murphy's Tim Brennan. That's next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
You want to talk about surreal?
Community, continuity, and the Boston Marathon.
Military people and people in hazmat suits combing that street looking for clues.
Reporter Edgar B. Herwick III.
And then when it first opened back up, there was a certain reverence for the space, for the place. And I think people were moving around very tenderly. But over time, you know, it has eased back into
WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
This program is made possible thanks to you and Sullivan Tire and Auto Service, with over 100 master technicians on staff, offering brand name tires and parts, committed to serving New England for over 59 years. Information and locations at SullivanTire.com. And WGBH's High School Quiz Show, Advanced Math and Science Academy takes on Lexington High School in the quarterfinals. Don't miss High School Quiz Show, Saturday at 6 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 for our Irish Spring Friday News Quizzer, Brian O'Donovan. He, of course, is host of WGBH's A Celtic Sojourn. How are you there, Brian?
Great to be here.
Good to see you. And representing, let's call it Celtic Punk, is from Boston's best band ever, I would argue, Dropkick Murphys, Tim Brennan. He's their lead guitarist. He writes, he sings, he plays accordion. Tim, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
We're so happy to have both of you guys here. This is absolutely wonderful. I should say I do listen every Saturday to Celtic Sojourn. Tell people what it is in case they don't know. They should, but just in case they don't.
That's great, Marjorie. It's great that you listen in.
I love it.
It's fun. It's a fun program of music from around the Celtic world, which is very broad these days. I often call it the traditional and contemporary music, and the roots and branches of Celtic music. Very vital, very vibrant, and it's just fun to be the curator.
Speaking of vital and vibrant,
yes,
the Dropkick Murphys. What was the Fenway deal like? You guys played on opening day, which was one of the most moving ceremonies. What was that? I mean, you do so much of this stuff. What was that like, Tim?
That was incredible. I mean, to even be asked to be involved with something like that is unbelievable. It's been a few years now that we've done stuff with them, and the fact that they keep coming back to us is fantastic. We're the type of guys that sort of always feel like they've overstayed their welcome in a situation like that, but they've been very kind to us. So.
And we should say you're a local kid, you're a New England kid, you're a Connecticut kid,
yes.
Now you're a Boston kid, so it has even special meaning for you and your bandmates, all that kind of thing. Do you want to say something nice about Celtic Sojourn? This would be a really good time to do.
I was telling him back there on the weekends in the morning. My neighborhood has a pretty heavy Irish contingent. My street specifically has a very heavy Irish contingent.
They all sound like me.
Where do you live?
In Brighton. Yeah. I think there's probably three different last names on my street, and I'm one of them. I'm one of the different ones. But on the weekends in the morning, you can hear Celtic Sojourn coming out of their windows.
Really?
Yeah. How
great
is that?
That's
so neat. Well, tell people who don't, because you guys are really famous. Everybody knows the Dropkick Murphys now. How'd this happen? How'd you get started in this band?
Me personally?
Yeah.
The first tour that I did with them was a 3-month summer tour, and I was selling their T-shirts. I was friends with a friend of mine. It's a long story, but the short version is a good friend of mine growing up was the guitar player for the band. I was going to Assumption at the time in Worcester. He lived in Worcester, so he and I would get together and play music, and he knew that I had the ability to play all these different Irish instruments and stuff. So one day he said, I threw your name out to the guys, and do you want to come out on the tour and sell T-shirts, and maybe you can play a song or two? And I said, absolutely. And I went out, and over the course of 3 months, it was one song, and then, by the end of the summer, I was playing, three or four songs.
So, sorry, go ahead.
No, well, and then shortly after that, I went back to school. And about a month or two in, I got a call from Ken Casey saying one of the guys had left, the guy that was playing all the Irish instruments, and they needed somebody full time.
Terrific. And,
so yeah. If you had a choice right now, you can only choose one, Tim Brown. You either could be in retail or be in one of the most famous bands in the world. Which would you choose, Tim?
I'll stick with the music. Playing music, yeah.
I had a feeling. And by the way, speaking of sticking with the music, we're going to do a couple of questions in a couple of minutes. Tim is going to be kind enough to play a little bit for us.
Yeah, before we do get to those questions, Brian O'Donovan, obviously you are Irish.
Definitely.
So,
I can't hide it.
I usually say
I'm actually from Billerica, and I get this accent from a correspondence course.
So how did the Celtic Sojourn happen besides your being an Irish guy?
Well, it was kind of a long story as well, but the short version is that I came back to graduate school here, went to Emerson College, when it was a very different Emerson College for my master's in the mid-80s, and broadcast on ERS, a program of Irish traditional music. And GBH called me a number of years later, and when GBH calls, as you guys
know.
That's right.
Yes.
You take the call. And asked me to come on and develop a similar program here, and I did. And Marjorie, that was 27 years ago.
Wow.
So it's quite phenomenal, the run that we've had here. But it's a great location for me. The audience is very interested in what we do, and it's really a lot of fun every Saturday afternoon.
Marjorie and I only have 26 more years to go, Brian, and we're there. Okay, shall we start? Do you want to ask questions of Marjorie? And I will do the other.
I can start with Tim.
Why don't you do that?
Right,
you start with Tim.
You ready, Tim?
Sure. As ready as I'm going to be.
Okay, here's Jimmy Fallon's take on a big headline from the week.
But this isn't good. Ooh, yeah. Dozens of students were arrested after they smashed windows and broke streetlights while celebrating their team's win. Yep, people in haven't gotten that rowdy since J. Crew had a sale in Pocket Square.
Okay.
I remember that weekend. Oh, tough.
Okay.
You did not want to be it.
Here's the question, Tim. What college do these rowdy students go to? Or another way to get a point is to name the state where this post-game celebratory destruction took place.
I can do both of those.
Great.
It's my home state of Connecticut, and it is the UConn Huskies.
Give the gentleman the points.
That is correct. So were you all excited this week with the UConn Huskies?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Men and women? Yeah, that was great.
Did you watch the women's thing?
Yeah, I did. I grew up in a Notre Dame family, so that's always the UConn Notre Dame games were always watched, no matter what was going on. But my father and I both tuned in to the women's game and were, you know, sort of texting back and forth.
And they beat Notre Dame, which is why
Jim
I bring
was
up.
Asking because he hates women's basketball.
No, I didn't. We did a show about it, and I was defending it, and then I watched it, and it didn't, whatever. In any case, you ready for this? Another Irish guy, Conan O'Brien. He's a Brookline kid, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
Brian, here's Conan O'Brien offering some news from the irony department.
In England, a movie theater had to cancel a showing of Noah due to a in the movie theater. Yeah. Either that or the 3D in that movie is really freaking good.
Here's the question. What happened, Brian, in the movie theater forcing them to cancel the screening of Noah? This is rather hard, actually. Do you have any idea?
I didn't hear this news, but I'm assuming that it was something like a leak, a flood.
Well, the judges are giving it to you. It was canceled due to flooding after an ice machine went haywire.
That's brilliant.
That was
an excellent guess. Tied 1-1, gentlemen.
Tied 1-1. Pressure's on. Okay, Tim, you ready?
Yes.
Who is Stephen Colbert talking about in this clip?
Newly released FBI documents allege that was a mob informant. He must have joined MSNBC as part of the witness protection program.
Okay, do you know who he's talking
yes,
about?
Yes, that would be the Reverend Al Sharpton.
That is correct.
Yes, it
Reverend
would.
Al Sharpton. I love that story.
That's a great
the
story.
The rat friend.
Exactly.
Rat friend.
Exactly.
What did he know and when did he know it?
Exactly. Okay.
You ready, Brian, to try to tie this thing up or no? Well, it doesn't matter if you're ready, actually. Here's your question.
No way out.
Listen to this joke first, and then I will ask you the question on the other side, please.
Just for something to do, I announced that I was retiring, and I'm hoping now that I can hang on long enough so my son can take over the show.
Yeah.
I'll tell you exactly the moment I made the decision to retire. A couple of months ago, cue card boy, Tony Mendez, cue card boy close to his 80s, he came to me and he said, I'm sorry, I just can't print the jokes any bigger.
Okay, here's the question. Who is speaking, Brian, and who will be taking his place?
Well, Mr. Letterman, one of my favorite late night hosts.
Me
and
too.
One of my other favorites, but not for late night hosting. It's going to be interesting to see how he does, Mr. Colbert.
That is correct. Are you a little anxious about that? We were discussing it with Emily Rooney a few minutes ago, whether you can make the transition from fictional character as host to actual normal human being with wildly great sense of humor. What do you think?
I think it's going to be interesting, but I think he could stay in character perhaps for a longer period than people are giving him credit for. I think it might suit that show for him to have a little bit of that edgy character, political humor.
Have you guys done these late night shows?
Yes, we
have
a few.
What have you done?
We've done Conan. Conan is a great friend of ours. He's the best. We've done Conan a number of times. We've done Letterman twice.
Wow.
We did Jimmy Kimmel, actually, the first time I was ever on television. We did Jimmy Kimmel.
Who's your favorite? You don't want to say because you're worried you won't be invited back?
No, absolutely not. No, Conan, I mean, Conan's the guy that, you know, is waiting in our dressing room for us when we show up. Mm. You know, we love doing the other ones. And we did Craig Ferguson as well. You know, doing Letterman was a benchmark for us, but Conan is like a buddy of ours.
When you get invited on Colbert, can you get me tickets?
Yeah, we'll see.
We'll see.
Did you see any like superstars in the waiting room or anything like that?
Charlie Sheen was on the last
really?
Time we were on.
Was he behaving?
Yeah, he was fine. I mean, he was just in his room the whole time.
Oh,
but,
okay.
You know,
Charlie Sheen and the Dropkick Murphys. Yeah. The mind boggles.
But I mean, we're seven just of the most normal people ever. So our reaction to these celebrities is the same as your average Joe's reaction.
Yeah.
So we're making sure that we're not in our dressing room so that when Charlie Sheen walks by us, we're all staring at him.
Well, by the way, the most embarrassing moment of Marjorie and my collective lives is we went to the Charlie Sheen show. At the Aganis Arena.
I remember reading like live tweets of that or something.
Oh my God. It was the most painful experience of all time.
I think he was under the influence.
Now it is 2-2 at the end of one round. You, I am told, were kind enough to agree to play a little something for us. Is that true?
Full disclosure,
yeah.
Jim.
Yes, Tim.
In the email, it said, "Will you bring your guitar?"
I said,
"Sure." So I brought it.
So
as far as what I'm going to do with that, now, hey, I'm a professional.
You are.
So yeah, we'll figure something out.
Okay.
But, I'm not sure exactly what that thing is going to be.
Yeah. Well, do you want to put it in your lap, and then we'll ask another round of questions, and then you'll do something with it? Is that a deal?
Okay.
Fine.
Sure.
I think Jim has to get his wallet out. He's a professional. He didn't do these kinds of
You can ask him a question in the interim, because it is tied 2-2, Marjorie.
It is tied 2-2. Okay. Where are we? Oh, we are at What Scourge is Affecting the American Southwest. Here's the tape.
It's a part of prairie life in the West. But this year, they're not just an iconic symbol. They're a true menace.
I had a couple delivery people call the house saying they couldn't get to the front door because the front door was blocked.
After a freeze in November, the broke off and took off.
They looked like sheep running across the prairie because the whole prairie was alive.
Okay, this is a hard one. Do you have any idea, Tim, what that scourge is they were talking about that's affecting Southwest America?
Helps him think.
I'm going to use context clues here and say tumbleweeds.
Wow, that is very impressive. An unusually dry winter led to an overwhelming amount of it in the brushy menace.
Okay, now
I had no idea.
Brian, the pressure's on. You have to answer this really quickly so we can hear Tim play. You ready?
Go.
What's Jimmy Fallon talking about here?
There's a computer that affected two-thirds of all the websites on the internet. And so security experts are warning people that they need to change all of their internet passwords. Then my mom said, no problem, just change my password to 123457.
What is Jimmy Fallon talking about
the
here?
The virus.
You know the name of the thing?
Can't get it.
Do you know the name of the thing, Tim?
Mm-mm.
Neither of them do. The same. But does he get points for this, judges? You have to decide. They're giving you the point. Oh, they gave you half a point.
I'm behind.
Is the heart bleed over?
No,
can
it
we
is
go
not.
Back?
Read Hiawatha Bray yesterday is frightening.
So we have to stay off. We can't buy anything for several more days, I guess.
Before we get to the bonus round, not only did he bring his guitar as requested, it appears he is ready to actually do something with it. Is that correct?
Well, what would you like me to do is the question.
Well, what do you do with it?
Normally, I just play it. Things don't really come out of my mouth so much while I'm playing it.
Mm-hmm. You can play
whatever makes you happy will make us happy, Tim.
Sing something. We'll harmonize.
Well,
no, we won't.
Do you want to sing something? What kind of traditional song could we sing part
anything
of or something like that?
Let me
just
think what you guys cover.
We're
talking about the Dubliners in the dressing
room. How about we do, a verse and a chorus of The Wild Rover?
Go for it. I mean.
Okay, we'll start with a chorus.
No, nay, never, no more will I play the Wild Rover. No, never, no more. I've been a Wild Rover for many's the year, and I spent all my money on whiskey and beer. And now I'm returning with gold and great store. I got a chance to drop kick mode. Never will play the Wild Rover no more. No, nay, never. No, nay, never, no more will I play the Wild Rover. No, never, no more.
Brian O'Donovan. Robin and Tim Brennan.
Do they still, fantastic.
Do they that still need great. A t-shirt salesman great. For the upcoming tour?
I'm you there. Work your way up. That's what you do.
I'm there.
Yeah, well, we couldn't have expected anything. When you said you learned how to play all these Irish instruments, was just when you were just a kid, you just kind of, was your family into the music, or how'd that happen?
It's when I was a teenager. What happened was when I was in high school, I was you know, I grew up listening to punk rock and stuff like that. And when I was in high school, my sophomore year, I had an English teacher who he was young. He was right out of college, and he was into the same kind of music. And one day he brought in, he knew that I also dabbled a little bit in traditional Irish music. One day he brought in the Pogues tape, If I Should Fall from Grace with God. Mm. And that changed my entire life.
One of the greatest recordings.
Oh, unbelievable! So still. I went home and absorbed that. And meanwhile, he was giving me some other stuff. One day, he showed up and he said, "Here's this new band. I think you're really going to like it. This record came out. It was Dropkick Murphys' Do or Die, the first Dropkick Murphys record. I had never heard of them before. This English teacher of mine in high school is the one that turned me on to him. He also knew how to play the tin whistle and." So one day he gave me one, and I went home and started playing along to the Pogues record on the tin whistle. And once I learned all those songs, I decided I wanted to try to learn other instruments. A friend of mine had an accordion in his basement, so I asked if I could borrow that, and I took that home and subsequently gave it back to him about 2 years ago. I learned how to play songs on that, and it just sort of went from there, and I just sort of picked up every wacky instrument I could so that I could play along to all these different songs, you know, because I wasn't in my room listening to rock and roll anymore. I was listening to these, you know, the Chieftains and trying to figure out how Paddy Maloney played the whistle that fast and stuff like that.
You know? Did you ever figure it out?
I could go about half his speed, I think, yeah.
That's the voice of story. Tim Brennan. The other voice is that of Brian O'Donovan. Now, this is the bonus round, gentlemen. Since it is tied, this will decide today's winner. Since today's theme is Irish Spring, we're going to ask you about the fragrant bar of green soap, which is called Irish Spring. First, let's get in the spirit, if we can.
You're a strong man, Brian.
Aye, am I too strong?
Then shower up with Irish Spring.
Okay, speaking of Brian, in this round, you will ask questions of Brian O'Donovan, Marjorie Egan.
Okay, here we go, Brian. Irish Spring was created in 1972. Until the 1990s, there was only one scent. It was known internally at the company as what? I'll give you three choices. Ulster Fragrance, Erin Go Breezy, or Shamrock Bouquet.
Yikes. What marketing guru came up with those names? Shamrock Cabrizi.
Nope.
Okay, you
nope.
can steal this.
Nope, you
want
to try? You want to give a guess?
Can you give me the two options one more time?
Yep, Ulster Fragrance or, what did
Erin
you say?
Erin Go Breezy.
I said Shamrock Cabrizi, isn't it?
No, Shamrock Bouquet. You
kind of combined two of
oh,
them.
Oh, no.
Well, I'll give you the three of them. Because Ulster Fragrance, Erin Go Breezy, or Shamrock Bouquet.
Well, now I don't know what the choice
he
is.
He said Shamrock, okay. But it's A or
he
B.
He combined two. Okay, so here's what I'm going to say. I'm going to say that is B, Erin Go Breezy.
Okay, it is not. It is Ulster Fragrance. Yes. It's the first one, so I'm sorry,
Ulster
you guys.
Fragrance.
So
don't we have one of those wah-wah-wah sound effects? What happened to that? There it is. Thank you
so
very
we're
much.
Both still tied, right?
You are, but yes. Here's where you can break into the lead, Tim Brennan. You ready?
Okay. Yeah, I'm ready.
Which of these is a true Irish Spring slogan? A, smell like you're worth exploring. B, if you're lucky Whoa. Enough to have Irish Spring, then you're lucky enough. Or C, get your clean on. Is it A, B, or C? Tim Brennan, please.
I'm, again, going to go with B.
That would, again, be wrong, actually. Yeah. And now it is either A or C, a great singer and host of Celtic Sojourn. That would be Brian O'Donovan. What is it, A or C?
I'm going to go with C.
That is also wrong. Now,
what? Can you believe they actually said this? Smell like you're worth exploring.
Oh, I'd buy Irish
What does
spring?
That have to do with...
That's the creepy,
we have no idea.
That's the creepiest.
So they were talking about Erin Go Breezy, but then they settled on smell like you're
yeah,
worth it
yeah,
or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, we only have 40 seconds. Let's call it a tie. Can we call it a tie,
we'll
gentlemen?
Tie.
Is that
yeah,
okay?
Fine. We're going to have to come back then.
Tim, where are you guys in the near future for your multitude of fans?
We're doing a short jaunt in May, and then we're going to be in Europe for about 2 months during all the European festivals, so not around here for a little bit.
And everything's on your website.
Everything is on dropkickmurphys.com.
Brian, what's coming up for you?
We've got a lot of things coming up, actually. I also helped put together Boston Summer Arts Weekend, which is coming up in Copley Square again this year, our third year running. Amazing folks to be announced that are going to be part of that outdoor free festival. And then we go on our learning tour to Ireland in October. People can join us, and it's around music.
Was it as much fun singing with him as it was listening to it?
Tim, that was a blast, actually.
Thank you so much. That was fantastic.
It was great to be witness to. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time.
Brian O'Donovan is the host of WGBH's Celtic Sojourn, which you can catch Saturdays at 3 o'clock right here on 89.7. Tim Brennan is with the Dropkick Murphys. He's their lead guitarist, vocalist, and one of the primary songwriters. You can keep on top of their performances, as Tim just said, dropkickmurphys.com. Thank you guys for listening to it.
Primary songwriter.
She got it from Al Sharpton.
That's right. That's right. Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. On Monday, we're all revved up with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Lawrence Mayer, Dan Rivera will also be here with us. We're going to talk politics as well. Our show's a production of WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am still Jim Browdy.
Thank you for listening to us. Thanks to Chelsea, Will, Amanda, and Alan. See you guys on Monday.